Let's take a deeper look at what's happening in Ukraine and why, with longtime analyst Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. And Ben joins us from the BBC studios in London. Start with the semi-autonomous Russian-friendly Crimea, where we just were. You say this is not like the 2008 Russian invasion of Georgia, because Crimea is not remote to Russians. It's the only lost land that Russians mourn.
Yes, there are two levels to that. Firstly, there's the historical level, and then there's the personal level. The historical level is that the Russian Tsarist aristocracy in the 18th and 19th centuries had ambitions for itself to be a crusading force in the world for all Orthodox Christians from Russia right down through the Balkans, and dreamed of one day liberating Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, or liberating Athens from the rule of the then Ottoman Empire. But the only part of the classical world, the only lands with Roman temples and Greek sites that Russia ever conquered, was Crimea. And this is how Crimea occupies more than a special place. It occupies an essential place in Russia's imperial imagination of itself as a great power. The second level is the personal. And Crimea is a place that millions and millions and millions of Russians have actually been. Why? The reason is that the Soviet Union turned Crimea into the people's holiday camp. So Crimea means for Russians their childhood, its happy memories, its warm memories in a cold country. Unlike other parts of the former Soviet Union, Russians still go there.
Well, and as we know, Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954, never dreaming that the Soviet Union would fall apart and Russia would actually, in effect, lose it. But just from what you've said about Crimea, just playing a little devil's advocate here, as you write, millions of Russians would applaud Vladimir Putin as a hero for returning it to them. Why wouldn't Russia be concerned about losing it? Why wouldn't a Russian leader want to return it to his people?
We live in a Europe where, ever since the rule of Adolf Hitler, the international order has been about stopping a major European power redrawing the borders of Europe by force. We've lived in a Europe ever since 1945, where the great powers have had an understanding amongst themselves that redrawing borders around ethnic frontiers is the road to violence and blood in a continent which has historically been Earth's bloodiest continent. And Vladimir Putin has, in moving into Crimea, just broken that. You know, Russia, the country whose greatest achievement was to liberate Auschwitz and to defeat the forces of Nazism, has become the first major power since the 1930s to embark on politics of expansion and de facto annexation.
Well, and you write about why Putin is emboldened to do it. You say once upon a time, Russians might have feared Cold War sanctions, being cut off of access to Western banking, for instance, but no more, because what matters to the West is money. Explain your theory about how money is playing a role here. What money?
Let me explain to you how Russian corruption works. Out of every dollar stolen in Russia, the majority of that dollar will end up in Western Europe. It will end up in French chateaus. It will end up in German oil and gas companies. It will end up, above all, in British tax havens and in London property and on the London Stock Exchange and in London hedge funds. Who are the people taking corrupt, stolen money out of Russia and bringing it to the West? These people are British bankers, they're French bankers, they are German lawyers, they're accountants. These people are the Western elite. Putin knows this. He sees that these, in the 21st century Western Europe, there are no sources of growth in London and Paris apart from living off oligarch rent. You know, Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron likes to say that Britain is open for business. Well, that sounds very charming, but what in actual fact that means is that Britain is open for the money of dictators to come and be placed and laundered in the capital, London.
Elaborate on that. You actually point to three former European leaders who you say are part of this.
Putin, when he came to power, Putin assumed the control of a Russia that had in many ways been ruined and driven into ruin by Western economic sanctions. And there was fear that Western elites were MI6, that Western elites were CIA, that they were cunning, determined, and they not only had economic power, but they were willing to use it. What Putin has been in power, dare I say, for quite a long time. And Putin has seen how the previous generation of European leaders turned out. Let's take the moralising Tony Blair, invader and democracy promoter in Iraq. This gentleman now works as a PR advisor for the dictatorship of Kazakhstan. Let's have a look at Gerhard Schroeder, former Chancellor of Germany. This gentleman was, of course, a very stern defender of human rights in Eastern Europe. But the moment he leaves office, he finds himself chairing a consortium of a gas pipeline of which Gazprom, Putin's state gas company, is the majority shareholder. Putin is seen in these people, but also in the smaller parts of the Western elite in banking and finance that he deals with every day in managing this nexus of corruption, that Western elites in the 21st century have the morality of a hedge fund, which is make the money and take it offshore.
Longtime Russia analyst Ben Judah. His book is How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. But in an article in Politico, he makes the case that Russian elites no longer fear the West. We'll link you to it at hereandnow.org. And we'll be back in a minute, Here and Now. It's Here and Now, and if you just joined us, we've been talking to political analyst and author Ben Judah, who makes the case that Russian President Vladimir Putin is confident that an invasion of Crimea won't bring any real action from the West because he believes the West has become dependent on massive Russian investments, billions of dollars that Europeans are willing to take from Russians sending their children to schools or buying up homes, or willing to launder and send offshore money. And Ben, Russian elites aren't laundering money in the U.S., but it seems you're saying that the U.S. has lost its influence over European leaders because so many of them are heavily invested in Russian money.
You're correct to say that Russian elites haven't invested in the United States in such the same way. And the reasons that they didn't is that they were fearful that one day the United States might impose economic sanctions, visa bans, the kind of banking restrictions that the United States has imposed on Iran to bring that economy to its knees. And they chose London, Geneva, Paris, Berlin, Rome, because these are smaller countries. They're far less economically dynamic countries than the United States, and they have been over the past 5 years for sure. And the flow of money has been so intense into these places, and the pickup has been so intense as well from these elites, that this is when Putin decided he should no longer fear economic sanctions coming out of Western Europe, because these elites have become practically dependent on the flow of funds from abroad and, of course, Russia.
Well, and you also say that this is maybe the answer to the question that many people had in 2011 when Putin returned to the presidency. And we know he's a former KGB officer. He's bemoaned the fall of the Soviet Union. He created the campaign, the Eurasian Union. No surprise that he wanted to recreate some of what had been the Soviet Empire's strength with the former republics, and he had planned to do that with including Ukraine. But you say this isn't about power in the way we think of it, the raised fist power of a former Soviet Union. It's about a cover-up of the financial relationship you've just described?
The most important thing to understand about Putin is he was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg in the 1990s. St. Petersburg was the mafia capital of Russia. Putin comes from a lost generation in Russia. These are people that lost their faith in socialism and authoritarianism with the fall of the Soviet Union, and these are people who lost their faith in democracy and capitalism in the 1990s. Putin believes that the only thing that matters in the world is money. Putin is a cynic to the bone, and Putin believes that Western elites are just like him. These are no longer the Western elites that led a crusading alliance in the Cold War. They're a different elite, and they can be brought and sold just like anybody else in Russia.
But Ben Judah, what happens? I mean, people aren't stupid, and we've seen what happened when the Ukrainians gained entry to the presidential compound and saw the pirate ship that was a restaurant and the zoos with the exotic animals. You write that as much as two-thirds of the $56 billion that left Russia in 2012 can be traceable to illegal activities, kickbacks, drug money, tax fraud. Can a leader possibly not know what will happen when his people find out how much of that money has left their country and maybe is being used to buy chateaus in other countries or fund illegal activities?
The more and more corrupt Russia gets, the more and more hysterical its propaganda gets. Russian propaganda has become unmoored from reality. On Russian state television, it is said that the European Union wants to impose homosexuality on Ukraine. On Russian television, it said that 1 million refugees are fleeing Ukraine. This is simply not true. This propaganda is reaching a fever pitch in Russia, and this is why it's happening, to cover up the fact that the Russian regime is above all an asset structure that rips money out of Russia and places it abroad and has made Western European elites complicit in that corruption.
That's Ben Judah. His book is Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.